Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and look into the anthrax story, where there appears to be some resolution in terms of who was behind the anthrax attack in Washington that closely followed the 9/11 attack in New York, Washington, and in Pennsylvania. And we'll be speaking with Dr. Ray Zelinskas, who is the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute for Nonproliferation Studies. He's the author of Biological Warfare, Modern Offense and Defense, and is the co-editor of the Encyclopedia of Bioterrorism Defense. He's currently writing a book on the former Soviet Union's biological warfare programming. And he was also a United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq. And, of course, weapons of mass destruction were not found in Iraq. However, they were unleashed in the United States Capitol, apparently by a member of the United States Army, at least a civilian member of the United States Army. We'll also speak with Dr. Alan Pearson, who is the director of the Biological and Chemical Weapons Control Program at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, where his work focuses on biological weapons, chemical weapons, and WMD proliferation. Pearson's work has also been published and cited in numerous publications, and he'll be joining us along with Dr. Ray Zelinskas. And then we'll turn to the subject of John McCain's national security advisor. His chief national security advisor he's been profiled by our guest, Zachary Roth, and we'll be talking to him about Randy Schoeneman, who was the go-to guy for Ahmad Chalabi in Washington in the build-up to the Iraq War. And, of course, Ahmad Chalabi is the famous con man embezzler and Iranian double agent that the neoconservatives in this country invested so much hope in the liberation of Iraq. And then we'll go to Islamabad in Pakistan and speak with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at the Qaidi Azam University in Islamabad, where he's taught for over 34 years. He holds a PhD in nuclear physics from MIT, and he's been a visiting professor here at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, University of Maryland, and Stanford Linear Accelerator in Stanford. And he's a member of the Permanent Monitoring Panel on Terrorism for the World Federation of Scientists. And he's in Pakistan, of course, and he's written a number of articles about the extent to which the radicals appear to be taking over Pakistan. The civilian government is weak and the military is bankrupt. We'll be talking to him about anti-Americanism in Pakistan in the context of the burgeoning Taliban menace and the Islamists in Pakistan itself. Let's now begin with a subject that's the breaking news this last part of the week, although the suicide, apparent suicide, did take place on Tuesday, I believe. We're joined here by Dr. Ray Zelinskas, who's the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute Center for Nonproliferation Studies, and Dr. Alan Pearson, who's the director of the Biological and Chemical Weapons Control Program at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. Thank you both, gentlemen, for coming here. Obviously, the case is not closed in terms of Bruce E. Ivins, the microbiologist who was working at USAMRID. He was apparently also consulted with the FBI on the materials that were sent through the mail to the media and to the United States Senate. Let me start with Ray, since you are a United Nations weapons inspector in Iraq, where there were no weapons of mass destruction found. It is an irony that weapons of mass destruction were unleashed on the nation's capital by an employee of the United States Army, apparently. Do you think, Ray, in retrospect, that we would have been better off using people like you, former UNSCOM inspectors, rather than the FBI?
No, I don't think so. They're completely different. The two cases pose completely different issues. With the Iraq situation, we were suspicious that they had biological weapons, but did not know when we started. And furthermore, the Iraqis, were supposed to give give us information on their programs. It turned out they didn't give us information, so we became kind of detectives. But we based our information and our search patterns mostly on intelligence sources, intelligence provided by the Israelis, by the Americans, and by the English, and so on. This is really a legal investigation in the United States. The problem was that the FBI and no other police agency had the expertise to really deal with these complex issues. So they had kind of to learn as they went along. And we have come a long way for those 5 years. So in a way, that was a very useful case study for future bioterrorist events, which poses both public health issues and forensic issues.
And Dr. Alan Pearson, the FBI, of course, always gets their man, in this case 7 years late, and after having wrongly accused somebody else who the government had to pay $5.8 million to. What's your sense of the FBI's role in this and the extent to which, having used the accused as apparently as a consultant, on the original investigation into the nature of the anthrax that was mailed to the Senate and to the media, is there any evidence that Bruce Ivins may have sort of diverted the FBI onto Stephen Hatfield?
Well, there's no evidence so far that he did that, but I think that's one question that has to be asked, not just about Bruce Ivins, who I think we need to remember right now is still just the alleged perpetrator of the attacks. We haven't actually been presented with any evidence thus far to demonstrate that he actually did this. But I think that question needs to be asked more generally also as to whether anyone at USAMRIID or elsewhere was trying to divert or in other ways impede the investigation.
Well, I suppose the suspicion that's attending the apparent suicide and the extent to which the FBI and the Justice Department were closing in on the suspect, apparently some of this will be answered this following week, or perhaps some more information from the grand juries and that have been looking into this. What's your sense, Alan Pearson, in terms of whether this is a case, as was the case with Hatfield, where somebody was under tremendous pressure from the government and cracked, this is speculating, of course, or conversely, he took the easy way out since facing up to what he's alleged to have done would be pretty devastating?
Well, those two options you lay out, of course, are not contradictory. He could have cracked and also actually been responsible. So I think the unfortunate thing here is that we may never really know completely what happened. And I think that just drives home the point here that we really do need to have a complete and thorough investigation of the events that took place in 2001 and of the events that have occurred since 2001 to understand what really went on here. I think the onus is going to be on the FBI and the Justice Department at some point to lay out fully what their evidence is so that it can get a close and critical examination. And I think ultimately what we may be seeing and what we may need is really a full and independent, perhaps congressional investigation of what happened in 2001 and since.
And Dr. Ray Zelinskas, there have been reports, the LA Times broke this story initially, and there have been subsequent reports that Bruce Ivins and a colleague would have benefited from a massive contract of $877 million for a anthrax vaccine that apparently Dr. Ivins was working on. Do you know anything about this program? I mean, I know you're writing about the Soviet program, and of course I've interviewed Ken Alabek, and I'm sure you have from Biopreparat, but offense and defense in biological weaponry are intimately tied, are they not?
That's true, but now, of course, the big difference between the Soviet and current American program is that the current American program, especially at USAMRIID, is an open program. So it's being reported on regularly to Congress. Now, as far as the vaccine issue, you have to remember at USAMRIID, they do perform research, both basic and applied research, to develop defenses that against weapons that the U.S. Army, well, U.S. military might face in different countries. So the problem is that they can't really actually develop and manufacture vaccines because that takes much, much more money and has to really involve private industry. So it's very appropriate for the USAMRIID researchers to do the basic research on vaccine research, not only for anthrax, but for all the select agents that might be a threat to the U.S. military. As far as them, the researchers who make discoveries in this area benefiting, it would have been a rather small benefit from him. And he, Bruce Ivins, I think he was one of five inventors, and they can only gain a maximum of $150,000, according to U.S. Army regulations. So I don't think that would exactly drive this kind of behavior. I think it'd be more likely that if there was any drive here, it would be for, should we say, patriotic reasons. In other words, that these people think that the U.S. is woefully unprepared to meet the challenges of a biological attack, whether from a foreign country or from terrorists, and we have to do something about that.
Well, in that context, Alan Pearson, $50 billion was cut loose to biodefense, including vaccines and others. And there's a lot of analysts suggest that there's been some massive boondoggles going on in here, and that perhaps vaccines themselves are not a particularly useful way to deal with an anthrax attack, that maybe it's more useful to have detection systems. And once you know people have been exposed to anthrax, it's easy to take Cipro, and as opposed to taking some of these vaccines, which some people have had adverse reactions to.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of controversy about that, and I think the answer to that question really depends on what the biological agent is that you're worried about. It also depends on who you're talking about protecting. It's one thing when you're protecting your military forces. It's another thing when you're protecting your civilian population. So I would agree with you that certainly there has been some controversy over what the biodefense strategy we need to have going forward is. I would also stress, I think, here another reason why we really need to get to the bottom of what happened back in 2001 is that we have to remember that that attack in 2001 is really the only significant bioterrorism attack, if it could even be called that, given the possibility that may have been simply more accurately described as a crime. But it was really the only significant bioterrorism attack that has ever occurred in history. The only other attack of significance that occurred in the United States was an attack by a cult up in Oregon back in 1989, I believe it was, that sprinkled some salmonella on salad bars in an attempt to make people sick so that they wouldn't vote in an election and thereby throw the election, which was really small scale. So it strikes me that it's very significant if, it, in fact, it turns out that the attack had its origin in our own biodefense program. That could have profound implications for what our biodefense strategy is going forward and how we should be viewing this problem. And this is yet another reason, I think, why we absolutely need to get to the bottom of what happened here to understand, ultimately, from a strategic national security point of view, what the problem is that we're looking at and how we need to best move forward.
And Dr. Ray Zelenskis, I guess in your research on your new book on the Soviet program, you're dealing with the Sverdlovsk incident, I imagine.
Oh, yes. It's been dealt with a lot, but we have some interesting new information about that. So, yes, it has a chapter by itself.
And, of course, Sverdlovsk is in the Urals. Boris Yeltsin happened to be the Communist Party chief at the time of this. The Soviets had put a factory right in the middle of the city to hide from U.S. satellites, and they forgot to put a filter in, so anthrax spores came out during the night. A number of people were killed.
Right, but Yeltsin was actually the governor of the province called Sverdlovsk. and the KGB and the military kept the details of that event secret from him. So in a way that demonstrates what Alan was just talking about, here you have a civilian authority that has responsibility for the civilian population of the town, and the accident involves a military facility where they're supposed to be doing defensive work. Of course, they weren't. They were doing offensive work. But anyway, here you have the facility that actually threatens the civilian population and the civilian sphere, and lies are being told to the civilian chief of that, in other words, Yeltsin. So what Alan was, I think, alluding to, which I also agree with, is our very own biodefense organization or structure that has been set up with that $50 billion might be a greater threat to our society than terrorists who happens, haven't done much, very much at all.
Well, let me ask Alan about the extent to which this incident played into the hands, if indeed it that the motive on the part of the alleged perpetrator of this was to get money and attention to vulnerability, and we know that that was the result. But it was also spun, I think, by some people in the government, in the press, to tie it into the build-up for the war against Iraq, the extent to which ABC News was fed the idea that the bentonite came from Iraq. And, of course, in the letters themselves to the senators and the media, there was a rather transparent effort to talk about an Islamic link there on the part of the perpetrator. So give us a quick sense of whether this became grist for the mill for the neoconservative efforts to get us into the Iraq war.
Well, I certainly think it did become grist for that mill. I think we need to be careful in speculating here that we don't go down the road of conspiracy theories and assume that somehow this was deliberately carried out for that purpose or any other specific purpose other than what is widely presumed, as Ray alluded to, that this notion that people, the person or people who carried out, may have been concerned that we were not paying enough attention to the threat of biological weapons. But, you know, that said, and totally without going down any conspiracy theory type of approach here, clearly the attacks played into many different interests there, including the interest of increasing our biodefense activities, concerns about Iraq at the time, concerns about Al-Qaeda, and so on. That's a case, you know, where something happens and then people take advantage of an opportunity there. So I do think, again, just come back to my earlier point, we do need to look at this carefully, and then we need to really sit back and think and take a very critical look at what the problem is we're facing and how we need to do that, how we need to address that. I think it's an opportune time for us to begin to do that, given that we're going to have a new administration coming in next January. And I think it's going to be imperative on that administration early on to take that look and to really look hard at that question.
And just finally, back to Dr. Zelenskis, obviously the Richard Nixon, when in unilaterally getting the United States out of the bioweapons business back in the early 70s, and eventually the International Convention was signed in 75, the Soviets were signatories to it, except they conducted an extremely massive and secret program throughout the 70s and 80s and 90s, including weaponizing SS-18 weapons, nuclear ballistic missiles with anthrax, I believe, and perhaps other things as well. So what does it say about the in terms of disarmament as opposed to non-proliferation? The idea that Nixon and company had was that these weapons are absolutely useless. We're better off without them. Could we ever go back to that kind of regime, or is the portent of terrorism such that we have to have this hedge? Because you just pointed out, Ray, that building all these facilities and the $50 billion that's poured into it in many ways in itself has made us more vulnerable.
Right. Well, we're not going to have a situation like the Soviet anymore, which was a massive program using large facilities, many thousands, tens of thousands of people. If there's going to be a biological weapons effort by, should we say, a smaller country or by a terrorist group, it's going to involve, way downsized equipment, a few highly trained people and more technicians, also highly trained. And we have kits now where you can actually do genetic engineering pretty much in a high school laboratory. So the whole scenery has changed as far as biological weapons programs on the national level. I'm more worried about what we hear about Al-Qaeda's interest in biological weapons, where they have an Egyptian microbiologist working to try to grow Bacillus anthracis cultures. And it was reported in the Washington Post last spring that they had a Pakistani microbiologist as a consultant. I mean, these kind of issues, I think, are more likely to be realized in the future than this kind of massive Soviet program. But having said this about the $15 billion program that we have, the defensive program, we can't just dismiss it as not having been useful. As a matter of fact, I have always held that it's been useful because it's done the right thing for the wrong purpose being bioterrorism, but the right thing is preparing for meeting the challenges of natural disease outbreaks. And our system was woefully poor in public health for surveillance and detection of these emerging and imported mostly tropical diseases, and we're in much, much better shape in public health than we were before 1996 when President Clinton started this effort.
Well, gentlemen, I thank you both for joining us. Obviously, there'll be more information this week. We expect more information from the FBI and the Justice Department, but I thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking then with Dr. Ray Zelinskas, who's the director of the Chemical and Biological Weapons Nonproliferation Program at the Monterey Institute's Center for Nonproliferation Studies, and Dr. Alan Pearson, the director of the Biological and Chemical Weapons Control Program at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation. I'm now speaking with Zachary Roth, who's a freelance journalist and a contributing editor to The Washington Monthly. He has written for The New Republic, Slate, Salon, Guardian America, The New York Observer, Columbia Journalism Review, among others. His latest reporting featured at Talking Points Memo shows that John McCain's chief foreign policy advisor, Randy Schoenemann, has a record of, errors in foreign policy. He was a prominent Iraq War advocate and architect, a member of the Project for the New American Century, and a close friend and advocate of the Iraq War's con man, embezzler, / Iranian double agent, Ahmed Chalabi. Was it true that he was considered in the belt within the Beltway circle, Zachary Roth, McCain's current national security advisor, at least the one that's likely to be his national security advisor and his chief foreign policy advisor? Was he the go-to guy for Chalabi?
Well, he was certainly one of the go-to guys. I mean, the truth is Chalabi had such an extensive network of Washington contacts in terms of Senate aides like Schoenemann and in terms of government people and journalists and so on, that there were a number of people he worked closely with. But there's no question that Schoenemann was one of the close ones. They were so close, in fact, as I reported, that when the INC, Chalabi's opposition party, moved out of its small Washington office in late 2001, they were so friendly with Schoenemann that they suggested he move right in. So he took over that office for his new lobbying business. And in fact, to this day, Schoenemann's lobbying address is the former address of the INC.
So this speculation about whether the neocons are up and the pragmatists are down in terms of John McCain's foreign policy vision and national security agenda, this guy being his top official in the national security team would indicate that the neocons have the inside track, in spite of the manifest evidence out there that their advice has been disastrous, their plans have been recklessly utopian, and the United States is infinitely worse off because of the influence that they've wielded.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I mean, one thing that the press, in my view, hasn't done a great job of so far is making clear that although McCain does officially have sort of more pragmatic realist advisors, as well as these neoconservatives, the neoconservatives like Scheuneman, but also like James Woolsey, the former CIA director, and Robert Kagan, who's one of the sort of intellectual architects of the Iraq War. Those are the guys who, in all my reporting has shown, and this is something I'm working on right now, really have McCain's ear and would be likely to play the pivotal roles in a McCain administration. And to give you another example of Scheuneman's role, he was perhaps the key congressional staffer as a top aide to Trent Lott in the 90s, who drafted and then helped to pass the Iraq Liberation Act. And that was working very closely with Chalabi as well. And that was really the piece of legislation which made regime change in Iraq the official government policy, which Clinton sort of reluctantly signed. And essentially that kind of put us on the road eventually to the invasion of Iraq.
And Kagan, of course, you mentioned, was one of the architects of the surge, and one of the most amazing disconnects in terms of reality having some traction here in our media and in the political debate. It seems that this kind of Rovian idea of emphasizing the surge and not the war is working. Most people in the press now faithfully repeat the canard that the surge is working. We may have lost the war, but the surge is working.
Well right. And perhaps in a sort of narrow, strict sense, the surge is working in the sense of reducing violence. But what that has to do with a long-term strategy is left unclear. I mean, another interesting thing about Scheuneman and many of these guys is that even once the war started, their judgment proved no better than it had been beforehand. Scheuneman and his allies were some of the key voices saying that we should give the UN no role whatsoever in Iraq, which was one of the early sort of disastrous decisions which we later sort of too late backed down from. And he also pushed for complete de-Baathification of the Iraqi government. The Ba'ath Party, of course, was Saddam's party, and he and other hardliners believed that you had to get rid of all of those guys. And more sort of realistic voices in the government were saying, okay, we don't like these guys, but they're the only ones who have experience running a government. If we bar all of them from government, it's going to be complete chaos. But those people weren't listened to, and we saw the results. But Scheuneman was one of the key sort of advocates of that policy.
Well, given that the neoconservatives and Scheuneman and company have deeply undermined U.S. security, because they have wasted so much treasure and lives on a total fool's errand going after a minor thug, the results of which were they made a serious enemy of the United States, the Iranian regime, much, much stronger. But more importantly, the focus of Scheuneman and I believe also McCain on the former Soviet Union, on Russia, is so counterintuitive and reckless. And you can argue that, I think you can make a clear argument that still to this day, the only people who can really do the United States any real harm is Russia. And here we are under the McCain-Scheuneman regime, which is pushing NATO up to their border, taking a hard line against Putin, who's very popular in Russia and in general, giving Putin an excuse to build up the Russian military budget because of manifest fears from the U.S. putting in anti-missile defenses in the former Warsaw Pact. The general idea is so counterintuitive to put Russia on a nuclear hair trigger as its early warning system decays is so mind-bogglingly stupid. I don't understand why nobody in the press is saying this is the McCain strategy. It is to push the Russians to the wall. And it's bad enough to have a nuclear war on purpose, but to have one by accident is pretty unconscionable.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't agree more. That's actually that's quite deep in Scheunemann's background, is a sort of ideological belief in taking that kind of aggressive policy toward Russia. As a lobbyist in the early part of this decade, he represented a number of the former Soviet bloc states. And you might remember how some of those countries, Poland and Romania and Bulgaria and some of the Baltic states, expressed their support for the American invasion of Iraq. Scheunemann, I believe, was working for them as a lobbyist at the time and reportedly offered that they were trying to get into NATO at the time. And he offered them assurances that their applications to NATO would be looked upon more favorably in the U.S. if they backed the U.S. invasion, which they ended up doing. And most of them are indeed now new NATO members. And that's obviously a policy that's putting us on a collision course with Russia. And we've seen the influence of Scheunemann on John McCain's thinking in that, in terms of some of the speeches he's given recently about Russia policy.
So why do you think there is this kind of vacuum out there in reporting on who the people are that are advising McCain? And extrapolating from that, you can pretty safely predict the kind of foreign policy that McCain has, which is based upon incredibly discredited ideas.
Yeah. I mean, to speak broadly, it seems like there's a sort of prevailing tacit agreement in the press and in the wider sort of dialogue around this campaign that we're not going to hold it against people just because they were big supporters of the Iraq war and they made the wrong call on that. In part because, honestly, so many people did. There were, as you know, plenty of Democrats who supported the war and who were saying some of the same kind of things. But it is pretty unbelievable that you would have one of the prime advocates of the war, in fact, a number of them as your top foreign policy people, and that wouldn't begin to raise questions about, is that really the direction we want to pursue in over the next 4 or 8 years?
So what's Obama doing? Because obviously he's able to get some press. He is the candidate that's opposing McCain. Why doesn't he start delineating an alternative foreign policy, criticizing McCain's, and smoking him out?
Yeah. I mean, it seems like Obama and Democrats in general would have needed to kind of lay the groundwork for that argument earlier by arguing not just that the war was sort of badly carried out and bungled by President Bush, as everybody agrees it was, but that in terms of policy, it was actually a flawed policy. And the very idea of invading a country of 12 million people and getting rid of the ruler and hoping that you can govern it effectively and turn it into a working democracy and a U.S. ally might be flawed from the start. That's, it would be great if Democrats felt able to make that argument. And at times you've seen Obama sort of gesture to it, particularly when he's recalled his early opposition to the war, where he said, I'm not against all wars, but I'm against some wars. But to be fair, it's a difficult political argument to make in the sort of heat of an election season. And so far, he's more often settled for just a sort of critique of the war itself and for pointing out the fact that he was right originally about opposing the war rather than making a sort of deeper argument.
Well, there were previous arguments that John McCain would and there are predictions that many of the guests I've had on this program in the recent past made that McCain was absolutely dead on arrival, and the only way that he'd ever get elected would be pull off some kind of October surprise with a war with Iran or something along those lines. But that appears to be, at least if you follow the polls, it doesn't look at all now that Obama is a shoo-in. And McCain may well be elected. The American people may well decide in their wisdom that he is the better steward of national security, and therefore that that kind of idea of something reckless and outrageous like an attack on Iran won't happen. So let me ask you about Randy Shulman's position vis-a-vis attacking Iran.
I mean, the Shulman and other sort of hawks have been very careful in their rhetoric about Iran. They'll use phrases like, we need to leave all options on the table. If Iran continues to develop its nuclear program, we'll have some tough choices to make, that kind of thing. But no one has been sort of reckless enough or stupid enough to come out and admit that they actively want to attack Iran. And I mean, it would be too far for us to say that they would intend to do that. But you can certainly say they are taking a very aggressive posture and in fact, are to the right of the Bush administration on it. Because as we learned in the last week or so, the Bush administration has begun diplomatic talks at quite a high level with Iran. And that's something that McCain, in his campaign rhetoric, and including Shoinerman, have opposed.
But on the other hand, just this last week in Washington, the Israeli defense minister, Barak, came to Washington to get assurances from the Bush administration and from the president himself that indeed a strike on Iran is not off the table. And apparently President Bush gave Ehud Barak those assurances.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think saying that something is not off the table necessarily goes too far. I mean, of course, Obama himself has said all options are on the table. The question is which options you want to prioritize. And it looks as though for the last few months of the Bush administration, they're not prioritizing the nuclear strike option, which I suppose is progress. But the McCain campaign has been much more aggressive in what it's been saying. And it's likely to take a much harder line posture if it was in office.
But every military analyst, in all the way up to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, have indicated that either a conventional or a nuclear attack on Iran would be a catastrophe, both for the United States' position in Iraq and particularly in Pakistan. And we'll be talking about that with the next guest from Pakistan, who's a nuclear scientist. The long and the short of it is that having this on the table is like saying something really crazy is on the table.
Well, I agree. I mean, part of this is sort of a game of political rhetoric. It's become sort of commonplace that candidates have to say everything is on the table, because if they say they've ruled something out or they've taken something off the table, it sounds weak or it sounds like they're limiting their own options. So you saw all the Democrats in the primary campaign, including Obama and John Edwards and Hillary, saying, yes, of course, this nuclear strike on Iran is on the table. But nobody, I think, believed that if they were in office that they would go that far. With John McCain, it seems to be a different situation, given the what he and his advisors have said.
Well, of course, Obama has said that he would, if he had actionable intelligence, that Al-Qaeda, there was an Al-Qaeda target in Pakistan, he would strike, regardless of the position that the Pakistanis would take.
Yeah, and McCain criticized him for being sort of overly reckless on that. But I thought that was quite a good way for Obama to sort of get to the right of McCain on foreign policy and show he's tough enough to do that.
So what's your feeling then about this campaign? As I mentioned, for the longest time it appeared that John McCain was Bob Dole without a sense of humor, and he was dead on arrival. And now we see the polls where it appears that Obama is not getting any traction, and he may have to take Hillary Clinton as his running mate. She's the only one who's going to bring any votes his way. Just in the closing, what's your reading on that?
Well, I don't think he's going to take Hillary Clinton as his running mate, and I think he'd be wise not to. It seems like the movement in the polls towards John McCain that we've been seeing in the last week or two has less to do with any of these questions of foreign policy that we're talking about and more to do with a sort of more focused and more disciplined attack message that we've seen from the McCain campaign. They sort of booted their former campaign manager upstairs and brought in a Bush Karl Rove protege. And since then, they've been really hammering Obama in a very concerted way about being sort of an empty suit and a celebrity,
right,
who, you know, has more in common with Paris Hilton or Britney Spears. As
well, that is an obvious tactic to keep throwing slime at him so that he'll be continually answering stupid questions and not talk about what he wants to talk about. That's kind of Karl Rove 101, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it's more than just creating a distraction so that he can't talk about the issues he wants to talk about. It's also sort of imprinting an image of him in the public mind as not up to the job and shallow and inexperienced and naive, and also sort of culturally different from mainstream Americans, in the same way that they did to John Kerry and Al Gore in the last two elections. That, you know, he likes to eat arugula, right, or he drinks this coffee drink, or all those same sort of cultural.
Yeah, he speaks French.
Republicans do.
I thank you. Sorry, we're running out of time here, but I thank you so much for joining us here, Zachary Roth.
Thanks for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking there with Zachary Roth, freelance journalist. He's been writing with Talking Points Memo. He's been doing profiles on John McCain's chief foreign policy advisor. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, who's a professor of physics at the Qaid-e-Azam University in Islamabad in Pakistan, where he's taught for over 34 years. He holds a PhD in nuclear physics from MIT, and he's been a visiting professor at MIT, Carnegie Mellon, University of Maryland, Stanford Linear Accelerator. And you've been writing I guess, for The Dawn, I think. Is that the paper you've been writing for in Pakistan, Dr. Hoodboy?
Yes, among others.
And among others, yes. About the growing anti-Americanism in Pakistan, and, of course, the growing menace of the Taliban and Islamists in general inside the state. I would have thought that after that Red Mosque incident, there would have been a little sobering in the country, and then the assassination of Benazir Bhutto. So why are the Islamists winning and the Americans losing?
It's because the government and the Pakistani state is unsure of itself and unsure of what it wants. It is now a fact that a part of the state wants one thing and a part of the state wants the other. And so when the Pakistani forces are sent in to fight the Taliban in the tribal areas, they don't do a very good job. Some of them have surrendered, others have been killed, and there's no heart. They're not fighting as a fighting force should, as a modern army should. And that reflects actually the basic confusion within the country, because the Taliban have a certain resonance within the society. And although many people condemn them for their extremism, yet there is a feeling that they're the only ones who are standing up to the Americans. And the anti-Americanism that has grown over the years, I think, is a very important impediment for us. By us, I mean those people who dislike the Taliban, don't want them, and yet they are forced to confront the fact that a majority of people in Pakistan are not willing to speak up because the Taliban are the only ones who are facing up to the Americans.
So let's examine then, Dr. Hoodboy, the genesis of anti-Americanism there. I take it that a lot of it is to do with the blind and unconditional and far too long support, or far too enduring in the face of total failure and unpopularity, of Pervez Musharraf, the military dictator. And two, the Iraq war itself resonates in terms of all the Islamic countries, because it appears that there's a crusader army in the cradle of Arab civilization killing innocent Muslims.
It's not just General Pervez Musharraf who has been supported by the United States. It's every military dictatorship since 1958, which was General Ayub Khan. We've had four military dictators, and all of them have been good friends of the United States. And the United States has supported military, not just military dictators, but very reactionary pro-Islamic dictators like General Ziaul Haq. Together with the U.S., General Zia launched the great global jihad against the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. And that was 1979. After that, the U.S., Pakistan, Saudi Arabia worked together to get the most experienced and ideologically charged warriors, Islamic warriors from across the globe. And then when the Soviets were driven out of Afghanistan, when they essentially collapsed, well, the U.S. just walked away from Afghanistan, and that created a lot of bitterness in Pakistan that, hey, we were allies with the U.S. We paid a lot in terms of, the awful things that had happened in the country. And then, the U.S. just walks away. So that's very important. But it's not just what has happened within Pakistan, although that's very important. It's also what's happened in Iraq and, of course, in Palestine-Israel. Now, the Palestine-Israel issue, it resonates across the globe. And it has a very important psychological effect upon people, and it generates a huge amount of anti-Americanism.
Well, let's not hold our breaths that Condoleezza Rice is going to pull off anything. Olmert, the Israeli leader, is perhaps facing jail, and that whole effort is falling apart. So nothing good is going to happen there. Iraq by a lot of analysts, is set to explode in spite of all the optimism about how well the surge is working. And then you have this possibility or threat of a possibility of a war with Iran, which some people dismiss as a psyop, a psychological operation. But there's enough to indicate that it might happen. Surely, if that happened, even though Pakistan is largely Sunni, if there was a war with Iran, many analysts think that that would be the tipping point in terms of Pakistan completely going unglued.
Well, perhaps. But I think that the tipping point might come in spite of that. The attack on Iran would be disastrous for other reasons. We know what they are, what will happen if Iran is attacked, the possibility of nuclear weapons being used, the enormous loss of lives, the general reaction that will occur across the Muslim world and so forth. But I think that the issue of Iran ought to be separated from what's happening in Pakistan. It's different and distinct.
Well, let's talk about what's happening in Pakistan then. Why is it hanging by a thread?
Well, let me tell you that I am very upset about the recent trends. I see them happening before me. Just 3 years ago, nobody had heard of the Pakistani Taliban. You know, after 9/11, the Taliban were driven out of Afghanistan. They lost the government in Kabul, and they sort of just disappeared. Well, we always thought in Pakistan that the Taliban were across the border in Afghanistan. And it's just 3 years ago that we first heard the name Tehrik-e-Taliban Pakistan, which means the movement of Taliban in Pakistan. And then the Taliban started spreading across the tribal areas. They went even into the settled areas, into places like Swat. And now they have started threatening places deep within Punjab. They were also in the heart of Islamabad until that Red Mosque incident happened and the military action took place and so forth. And so the Taliban have been consistently gaining ground, and the state has just twiddled its so to speak, and done nothing about it.
Well, you have a very, very weak civilian government at the moment. Under Gilani, who was just visiting George Bush last week in Washington, where apparently George Bush unloaded on him about evidence that the CIA has, that the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service, were involved in helping militants blow up the Indian embassy in Kabul. There is obviously, the government's paralyzed, the civilian government's paralyzed between factional fighting between the Pakistan People's Party, the former party of Benazir Bhutto, now somewhat in the hands of her widower, who himself has been under a lot of indictments as a kind of bagman. Then you and you've got Sharif's people jockeying. So, is there any possibility of a coherent and strong civilian government? Because I'm sure you're aware that efforts to rein in the ISI and put them under the Ministry of Interior, in other words, civilian control, lasted all of a few hours, didn't it?
Yes, it was very embarrassing. Here was the government saying that the ISI will now be answerable to the Interior Ministry, and a day later it has to take that back because there was such enormous pressure from the military and the ISI itself. The ISI has become virtually a state within a state. And so this so brilliantly exposed the weakness of the civilian government. And it's not just this government. Every government has been has had little power in face of the military and the ISI. And so now the question is, can Pakistan afford the ISI and the military to conduct a foreign policy which is different and in contradiction with what the civilian government wants? It's becoming a situation which is very dangerous. Now, I personally don't believe that the bombing of the Indian embassy in Kabul or the bomb blasts that have occurred in India were done on the directive of the civilian government. It is quite possible that the ISI might have done it, but then the question is, was it a rogue element within the ISI, or was it ordered from the top of the ISI and the military? It could have been either.
Well, it's worth noting, surely, Dr. Pervez Hoodboy, that the current head of the ISI is a relative of Musharraf, and the former head of the ISI is now the chief of staff of the army.
Well, that's true. And yet, there is a very strong rogue element within the ISI, and one sees that because in the last several months, the ISI has been targeted, and its officers and employees have been killed by suicide bombers. And those suicide bombers obviously operated because they had inside information. Now, let me give you an example, and it happened very close to where I am in Islamabad. So this was a suicide bomber in a truck, in a pickup rather. He was following a bus of ISI employees, and as they passed the guard post, he stopped there and he showed his identification. He showed the code for that day. And before the guard could realize that this was yesterday's code, the suicide bomber had already gone through and he blew up that bus, killing 17 ISI employees. Now, that sort of thing has occurred in other places as well. And that tells us that the ISI is infiltrated from within.
But when is the day of reckoning going to come for both the ISI and for the country itself? Because surely the majority of the Pakistani people must see the malignant nature of what the Taliban and the Islamists stand for, which is the oppression of women. Girls' schools have closed down. You can't even fly kites. I mean, it's monstrous. And manifest. And I understand that Peshawar itself it may fall to the Taliban. And if Peshawar falls, that's the route into Pakistan, into Afghanistan. That's where all the NATO troops get their supplies coming through. So it's very easy to be pessimistic here, but it's very puzzling not to understand why there isn't some kind of day of reckoning where everybody wakes up and says, wait a minute, we're heading in a very, very dangerous direction. And once you pass a certain point where a theocracy takes over, it's very, very hard to come back.
There's no doubt that there is some awakening. People have started writing, hey, what kind of liberation is this, where you blow up girls' schools, where you threaten women with disfigurement if they appear in public without the burqa. What sort of a world do these people want without any form of entertainment, where you are subject to vice and virtue squads? Yes, there are people now who are beginning to talk about this, but will this enlightenment come in time? That's what I'm worried about, because what one needs is massive public awakening, and that's something that the government ought to be doing. It ought to be discussing the Taliban agenda in public, on the mass media. Now, in Pakistan, there's a very vibrant public media, television, the private television channels that have opened up, and you see all sorts of discussions happening over there. But there's very little of what the Taliban are doing. And here is what the government actually needs to do. It needs to build a consensus within the Pakistani public against the Taliban so that they can be fought militarily.
But unfortunately, anti-Americanism distracts everybody from focus. And I mean, isn't that the tragedy, that the United States has managed to make itself the bad guy here instead of the real bad guys?
You've put your finger on the right spot. Absolutely. This anti-Americanism, which is both legitimate and illegitimate, is really what's distracting the whole struggle. That's what's causing people to take the wrong side. Now, I think there are a lot of reasons for the Americans to be criticized, I think justly. Look what they've done in Iraq and Palestine, how they treated Afghanistan after the Soviets left, and so forth. But I think that in our situation, those issues must become subservient to the real issue. And the real issue is that the Taliban are advancing, and these are barbarians that we're dealing with.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today. I'm sorry we've run out of time, but thank you so much for joining us, Dr. Pervez Hoodbhoy. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Pervez Hoodbhoy, who's in Islamabad, Pakistan. He's a prominent nuclear physicist there, and he's taught at the University of Qaid al-Azam University in Islamabad for 34 years. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Elliot Fong, the associate producer, Lik Duan, the assistant producer, Melissa Figueroa, the engineer.